Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It. I'm Jenna Flanagan, filling in for Allison Stewart. My next guest hardly needs an introduction. If you watch PBS or listen to public radio, like you're doing right now, chances are you already know who Bela Fleck is. The world-class banjo player is a 15-time Grammy winner who's been nominated in more categories than any artist in Grammy history. He's a pioneer who has paved the way for banjo beyond bluegrass and folk and into the realms of progressive jazz, classical, rock, and more. He's worked as a solo artist with many other great musicians like Edgar Meyer, Chick Corea, and his wife, Abigail Washburn. But he's maybe best known for his work with his band, Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, which he formed back in 1988, just over 30 years ago. They're on tour now commemorating that milestone, and they'll be at State Theater New Jersey in New Brunswick this Friday. But before then, Bela joins us in the studio with his banjo. Bela, welcome to All of It.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So first I have to ask, you brought your banjo. Could you please give us a short song?
Sure.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Might I inquire as to what song that was?
Yeah, it's a tune called Sunset Road. Sunset Road was on the first Flecktones record, and it's a good one because it's not that hard to play first.
Well, that's definitely a good help, especially when you're on the spot. Can you play for me?
Yeah.
But I did want to ask about the tour that you're on right now.
Yeah.
Celebrating, first of all, what's it like? Did you think that when you started the Flecktones all those years ago that you'd be doing a 30th anniversary tour?
No way. No, it was just this crazy fun thing that I was going to try. I had an unusual opportunity. Someone asked me to do a television show to showcase my banjo playing, which was unbelievable, especially at that time. And I did a variety of things. I had a piece for banjo and string quartet. I had some banjo and computer music I was playing live. And then I was putting together a weird group. And it was supposed to be a jazz group, but I just found these crazy guys and put it together. And when we came on stage, we were very unrehearsed. But it just clicked. The audience went crazy, and we were all sort of stunned by the reaction to it. I mean, we knew we were all weird, but we were all used to being weird in our, you know, in our rehearsal rooms by ourselves, nerding out, you know, practicing and working on stuff. But there was just an incredible reaction. And as we left this show, we all looked at each other and said, "We got to do some more of this." And gradually it took over all of our lives for quite a long, long time, which was a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Well, what's it like being, I mean, we hear so many stories about, you know, groups or whatever, they get back together, they go on the road for the 30th anniversary tour. And I've seen a couple of those shows. Sometimes it looks as if people are really just there to be there. But how do you keep that energy, that passion after all these years?
Well, the trick is to just not do it all the time. Like, make every time special. And in the past, we would never go on tour unless we had a brand new record and we were working on new music, and that would be the sort of the point of the tour. We'd be practicing all the time, and we'd go out and play a lot. But these days, everybody's lives are so busy. We've all got so many good, you know, great things going on, and families and so forth. So now we get together two or three weeks of the year, and so it's a very rare thing. And when we do, it just sort of it's very precious to everybody. It's like a very special family reunion, and we get to love each other and play together and feel that bond, which is a really big important part of our lives. And there might be a time when we want to do a project and do a more serious tour again, but for now, it's kind of been wonderful. And this year, we're doing a lot of the holiday music too, which is fun, because we did this crazy Christmas record a number of years ago, and we did things like 12 Days of Christmas in 12 keys and 12 time signatures and things like that. And it's just funny music. It's amusing and fun to try to play. And so, you know, we like those kind of high jumps where things are really egg-heady and hard, but somehow they reach people, and it's fun too.
Plus, I got to imagine that it keeps everything fresh for you guys, and that there's still an ability to have that sense of, you know, creative challenge, if you will.
Yeah, I've always felt the band did the best when we had, you know, challenges. So when you only play for 3 weeks of the year, then there's a challenge of like relearning this really hard music. So the first couple of days are about that, and then everybody's kind of looking around for something to do. So this year it was the holiday music, but generally a couple of new tunes start to emerge at soundcheck, and pretty soon we're playing them on stage. But the spontaneity of the group has always been one of its greatest assets, and so, you know, playing the songs again is not a chore, because we're going to do them differently. We're going to stoke each other up, and everybody's going to give it 300%. And this tour has been off the hook, I have to say. And I'm not a self promoter, but this, you know, self congratulator. This, I'm usually the one that's talking about how everything sucks, but this tour is really, the guys are just blowing me away. And then once somebody brings that special thing to a song, the next guy has to follow it with something unconscious, unplanned, and you know, totally spontaneous. So there's a lot of that going on, and there's a lot of joy in the room.
And is it essentially the same lineup that you had from 30 years ago?
Yeah, the crazy thing is it's like getting back together with your old partner, you know, your ex-wife or something, but which is not going to happen, by the way, for me. But at any rate, yeah, he left after 3 years, and for 14, 15 years, we had different people. And then the band kind of went on hiatus for a while. Our wonderful saxophone player left the band to join Dave Matthews' band after his saxophone player died. This is Jeff Coffin. So Jeff was in the band for 14 years. And then when Jeff left, we had the time to rethink how we wanted to do the Flecktones, because we knew he was going to be doing that from then on. And we asked Howard if he would like to come back. And the band was really put together with these four people in mind. I love all the different people who've played with us, but this is really, when I think of what the Flecktones was supposed to be, it was like four inventors, people in the band. If people don't know about this band, everyone in it is a creative dynamo. Our bass player, Victor Wooten, is one of the greatest electric bass players in the world, and does a lot of techniques on the bass that are really new to the instrument. Howard Levy is a harmonica player that has redefined the blues harp. He can play all the chromatic notes on it and all kinds of music on it that the harmonica doesn't even have those notes on it. He manipulates the notes with his powers and changes the, you know, the white keys of the piano to all the keys. It's just bizarre.
Wow.
And he also can play multiple things at one time, like multiple lines with different sides of his mouth. And he's an unbelievable jazz pianist as well. And then Future Man is even crazier. He plays this electronic drum kit called the Drumatar with his fingertips. And he walks around. He can stand face to face and be playing, you know, unbelievable rock and jazz drumming. And he has a lot of instruments on stage too now, but he's created this whole unique, amazing thing. It sounds like a terrible idea, banjo and drum machine, but when you hear it, it's like, it's not a drum machine. It's a living, breathing instrument, and he's just a god of music. So all of these guys are crazy, and I just found them because I was looking for brothers, you know, that were as weird as I was, trying to play the kind of music I wanted to do on the banjo.
All right. I'm Jenna Flanagan, filling in for Allison Stewart, and I'm speaking to Bela Fleck. I'm wondering if I could ask you for one more song before we move on.
Absolutely. I'll play something.
Okay. Thank you. again, amazing. I gotta say, I'm not an aficionado, but that sounded just a hint of a familiar riff.
I learned it from a Marx Brothers movie.
Okay.
Chico played it on the piano. It's called Pizzicato by Delibes.
Okay. Well, I do want to talk a little bit about your early life, because I think a lot of people, when they think about a banjo, they, of course, think, you know, Southern music, bluegrass. And you're a New Yorker. You're from the Upper West Side.
That's right.
How did you end up with the banjo being your signature instrument?
It's just one of those things. It makes no sense at all. There was no music in my family really at all when I grew up. My grandparents let me and my big brother, Louis, who's out there somewhere, by the way, he works at BAM, and they let us watch the Beverly Hillbillies on their TV when I was maybe five and Louis was six, and this banjo playing came on, and it was Earl Scruggs playing the banjo, and he's the guy who started this rippling three-finger bluegrass style and made it famous in the 40s with Bill Monroe. And for some reason, it just reached out and grabbed me and just bonked me on the head. I just loved it. I didn't know what it was, and the cultural aspect of it didn't mean anything to me either. It was just a sound.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out, as I've gone on into this banjo world, that most of the great banjo players that I've met have a moment when they hear Earl Scruggs, and it changes their life. It's like before and after. And it was like that for me. From then on, I was interested in the banjo. I didn't really care about bluegrass or country music. I was a New York City guy. I liked jazz. I liked the Beatles. I liked everything that was happening in the 60s, such a rich time for music. I wasn't against, you know, folk music, but the singing actually, I remember saying in one NPR interview that Bill Monroe's singing reminded me of cats being slaughtered.
Oh.
It was not a good thing to say if you want to have a career in the bluegrass world as
no,
a New Yorker.
No, it's not going to make anybody happy.
But I also said it was kind of like coffee, like when you're a kid and you taste your mom's coffee, you're like, why would you ever want to drink this? But as you continue to drink it, all of a sudden you get acclimated and one day coffee becomes this incredible joy. And I think of some of these kinds of... Well, I think about that with ethnic music, too. You know, you start out and it's alien and it's interesting or repelling even. But then as you get into it, all of a sudden it becomes your favorite, the richest stuff that you experience. And I feel that way about bluegrass and bluegrass singing. I think it's a great American offering. But as a New Yorker, I was really confused as to why I was playing it. I was always being asked. I was always trying to play other things on the banjo besides bluegrass. And eventually I decided to just move down south and sort of face it and really learn to do it better. Because in the North, people tended to be better at some of the modern styles. That was what we were known for in New York. People, great players like Tony Trischka and Bill Keith, were expanding the whole language of the banjo in incredible ways. And Tony still is.
Mm-hmm.
But so then I really started getting into it even more and playing with guys from that part of the world. And that helped my appreciation. But meanwhile, I was always also working on my jazz and classical and just technical understanding of the banjo to the point that when Victor Wooten and Future Man and Howard Levy appeared in my life, I was ready to go. I had some music I wanted to play with guys like that.
When you moved down south to sort of further your understanding of the banjo, because the region is so big and
right.
There's different musical styles from part to part, where were you in the south?
I went to the South Bronx. banjo, I went to Lexington, Kentucky first, and that was because there was a great traditional player there named J.D. Crow, and a whole world of people had moved to that town around him, bands of people that played him with him. So I could go see him play all the time, and I joined a band down there, kind of just to be around that influence, and that really taught me a lot about the tone and the time and the feel that traditional bluegrass is supposed to have.
Mm-hmm.
And I always feel like I brought that into the Flecktones. Like we're not bluegrassy at all. In fact, for the first years, I tried desperately to keep us from being seen as a roots act because I wanted us to be taken seriously as a jazz group. But as time went on, I began to realize that was like cutting off your nose to spite your face because it was such a big part of who I was, and that should be part of what the band is. So we started incorporating tunes that blended that bluegrass and jazz and funk and all the different things that the guys could do, and that felt better to everybody.
Well, I also want to find out a little bit more about your technique because you mentioned being a three-fingered player, I believe.
Yeah.
What is that? How does, I guess, that change the tone or the sound of what you're able to do with the instrument?
Right. Well, when Earl Scruggs came along, very, very few people were using the three fingers on their right hand. We're talking about the right hand when we talk about three fingers, the thumb, the index, and the middle on the right. And so what happens is you've got five strings on these banjos, this type of banjo that we play. You've got three fingers, and you're plucking. You're alternating those three fingers in a way. I don't know if this mic is still on, but you're just going from one finger to the next. So no single finger actually has to move very fast. I'm not even using my left hand right now if I'm just using my right hand on the open strings. So it's all about learning how to make that happen, that rippling thing, and alternating again. Three into five is an odd mathematical equation, so it delivers a lot of syncopation very naturally, and that's what you hear when you hear Earl Scruggs. If you were to listen to the Foggy Mountain Breakdown recording or something like that, you'd hear not just this drive, this incredible drive, and this amazing sound that he got, but also these rippling, cascading syncopations. And so that's why I think the banjo is just such a unique, weird, wonderful instrument. And also, let's not forget that it comes from Africa and it came over here with slaves. And so it's another weird instrument that started as one thing and turned into another thing. And maybe one of the, you know, there's a positive. Occasionally there are some amazing positives coming out of our culture, is where these things can mix and these hybrids can come up and some amazing things can happen. With the craziness.
I'm Jenna Flanagan, filling in for Allison Stewart, and I'm speaking with Bela Fleck. We'll be right back with more from Bela after a quick break. I'm Jenna Flanagan, filling in for Allison Stewart, and this is All of It. And I'm speaking with banjo aficionado Bela Fleck. We were talking a little bit about the technique that you use and how unique it is to be able to play with three fingers as opposed to, you know, what came before. Yeah, exactly, yeah. What came before. But I also wanted to find out a little bit about what was that process like of you learning about the history of bluegrass and bluegrass music, and then being able to take that, and I don't know if you had to push it into jazz or into more modern music, or was it open? What was that like?
Well, there were both factions at the time. There were the hardcore traditionalists who loved Flat and Scruggs, who I also loved, that didn't want that music to change. It was a part of their identity. And then there were the young folks coming into it, and these are folks that a lot of them became very famous in later years, people like even Jerry Garcia and David Grisman and Tony Rice and Sam Bush. They were kind of renegades, and they were bringing this, the music revolutions of the 60s into bluegrass music, and there was some kicking and screaming going on. There was a magazine called Bluegrass Unlimited where people would rage about people like even Tony Trischka, who was my teacher, for what they were doing to bluegrass music. But it was inevitable. You know, music's not a history. It's not a museum. It's got to move forward, and the music moved forward in a beautiful way, and a lot of great people were moving. And when I came into it, I just happened to be the next guy, you know, with the new influences coming into it and continuing that journey for bluegrass. But I think what was good about what I did is that I did go back and study the origins and really take the old styles very seriously, especially coming from outside of the music like I did. I mean, someone like Sam Bush or Ricky Skaggs, they changed it too, but they grew up with it and they knew what it was supposed to sound like. But I was an outsider, so for me it was important to put in that time. And then, I mean, the truth was I was already, when I heard Chick Corea and Return to Forever play at the Beacon Theater in 76, I guess it was, I wanted to do that from then on. I wanted to be in a crazy instrumental band with virtuosos doing modern, you know, inventive music. And I just happened, and people say, why don't you play the guitar or the saxophone or the piano if you're going to play that kind of music? I was like, I don't love those instruments. They don't turn on my fire, you know, but this does. So it just, and people would say, oh, you're not going to be able to make a living, you know, everybody advised me against it. You should go to college, you know, but
I'm fairly certain people say that too, just about all performing artists.
Yeah, and you know what? It's good advice because very few people break through. But I'm glad I didn't listen to him. In my case, I had a strong sense of myself and belief. For some reason, I believed that I could find a way in that world, and I did. And so I was one of the lucky ones. Because yeah, a lot of people go through that process of believing in themselves, and then they have to reduce their expectations. But my expectations have generally been shattered in how well it's gone. Like they're playing at places like Town Hall on a nightly basis around the country and playing, you know, with so many wonderful people. It's just not, it was a dream that I wasn't really necessarily expecting to come true, but it's gone very, very well.
That's always, I think, the greatest way to have a dream is those unexpected moments. I'm wondering what's been the most unexpected experience for you as a musician, be it a genre that you were able to break through in and be accepted as, or an audience perhaps where you could tell that you were opening up their minds to a sound in a atmosphere that they weren't used to.
Well, I think that's sort of the norm for me, because I'm almost always playing. Like if I'm playing with Chick Corea and we're doing duet concerts, which we've done quite a few, people are always surprised. A lot of them don't know me, you know, and they're like, why is Chick Corea playing with a banjo player? And then it's my job to sort of fight for the honor of the banjo and prove that jazz could be done on the banjo. And even though I consider myself a neophyte jazz player, you know, I do the best I can, but I also play a lot with Zakir Hussain, a great Indian tabla player, one of the greatest musicians in the world. And when people come out to see me play with Zakir and Edgar Meyer and Rakesh Chaurasia on bamboo flute, they don't know what they're going to hear, and they're usually surprised. But I would say the biggest surprise for me was the classical album that I did. And I just played that classical, you know, short piece. Mm-hmm. I did an album. Actually, it was Peter Gelb who signed me. He runs the Metropolitan Opera now, but he signed me to Sony Classical, and I did a couple of records for them. This one was called Perpetual Motion, and it was all, you know, classical works on transcribed for the banjo, and it won 2 Grammys in the classical field, which was, again, you don't expect that to happen. I thought that was more than a long shot.
I would imagine that would be the genre where it was just like, so this is happening.
Yeah, it was bizarre. It was wonderful, but a lot of people told me that they just didn't make any sense to them. It just surprised them so much to hear that music played on the banjo. And I guess I did it well enough that it was, you could take the music seriously. It wasn't like a joke or a novelty thing that I was really trying. And I was playing with Joshua Bell and Evelyn Glennie and Edgar and people like that. And actually, Chris Thiele was on that record too. So that was a good surprise there. But going to Africa and being reconnecting with that side of the banjo was also went incredibly well and was life-affirming and unexpected. I've had a lot of really great journeys, and I hope they continue.
It sounds like definitely. I would imagine also playing an instrument like the banjo, being able to not just go to Africa, but you also mentioned an Indian musician. I know the sitar isn't exactly the same thing, but being able to sort of musically relate to people who are playing instruments that are so very, they're in sort of the same family, if you will.
Well, that's what's funny, because people bring their perceptions to it. So if I'm playing classical music, for instance, Perpetual Motion, people would say, I didn't know what it was. I thought it must be a harpsichord. That's what they could imagine. When I play with Zakir, people say, it sounded like you were playing the sitar. It's the same instrument. I'm not doing anything different. I'm not making a different sound. But it's when you place yourself in different settings that it changes your whole perception of something. And that's something that I've learned in my career.
Well, speaking of perception of something, your name definitely, I think, would put forward a certain perception of you. It's not an accident. I believe your parents chose your name for a very specific reason. So can you
Right.
tell us?
Right, so I was named after all of these great classical musicians, classical composers, which is pretty wacky how it's turned out. Bela Anton Lajos Fleck, Bela for Bela Bartok, Anton for Anton Webern, and Lajos for Janáček. So some pretty out there wacky composers. And I was named that actually by my father. And the crazy story about it, I don't know if anybody out there has ever heard this song by Johnny Cash called A Boy Named Sue, where the father names him Sue so he'll learn how to fight. But it was kind of like that. I was named Bela, and then they split up, and I never saw him till I was in my 40s. They split up when I was 1 or 2. So it was funny. I had all these names, but I didn't know what they meant, and I didn't really, you know, there was no interaction for all that time. So that's the true story of what happened and how I got those names. What's ironic is that my mother married a wonderful man named Joe Palladino, who's a cellist, and so he actually brought a lot of influence. But those guys probably wouldn't have been his favorite composers. He was more of a, you know, Strauss and Bach and, you know, Sweeter stuff.
Yeah. Are there any other or any new musical spaces that you haven't been in? It feels like an odd thing to ask you, but any other musical spaces that you haven't been in that you're kind of itching to, or perhaps when you're listening to music of today, you're like, you know, I could work with that.
You know, maybe, you know, I listen, when I hear a hip hop record, sometimes I go, God, banjo would sound good just rolling along in that groove. You know, sometimes I hear things and I think, I wish somebody would call me to play on a Beyonce record or you know, some of the things that I hear, because the banjo is funky and it actually is very rooted to the African experience. A lot of people don't realize that anymore. But yeah, so I hear all kinds of things. I hear trance music and I go, oh, that would be neat. I hear opera and I go, I would like to be the, you know, support the vocalist and be the accompanist instead of a piano on something. Or, you know, I hear all kinds of things. And but the things that really get me going are things that I really think I can learn a lot from. And that's why playing with someone like Zakir or Chick Corea or the guys in the Flecktones or Edgar Meyer is so inspiring, because I go there to learn and I'm going to find out things that they have knowledge that I don't have. And when I find knowledge that I don't have and I can try to figure out how to apply it to the banjo, it just gives me new tools to work with in my own composing and my own playing and sort of the gumbo of whatever I am.
Now, is that one of the better musical experiences, I guess, to have, where you're with other musicians and you are learning with each other? You're not necessarily working for, like, you play this and only this.
Right.
Your work, it's much more of a fluid, living thing to be able to play with them.
It is, and some music is very specific, and you do, you know, someone says, here's the song, and I really need you to play this, and some music is very fluid and open, and there's a rough structure, and you get to just insert your own ideas. And I think you should be good at all of those things if you're a musician trying to interact with people. You should be prepared to play what's asked for, and you should be able to bring something of your own. And you should also find a way to play what's asked for while bringing something of your own. Find a way to put yourself into it, someone else's notes. That's a whole... Interpretation is a big part of singing, obviously, but it's a big part of everything.
Well, can we ask you to play one more song and perhaps put some vela into it?
I will. Thank you.
An applause button every time you play. So I can't let you go without asking, is there anything that you're working on at the moment that you're particularly excited about or inspired about?
Yeah, I'm actually doing a bluegrass record for the first time since 1996.
Wow.
And playing with a lot of my old friends from that world, some of the people we were talking about, David Grisman, Sam Bush, Jerry Douglas, Stuart Duncan, a lot of these guys that are icons on the bluegrass world, but also a lot of the young players, like, again, Chris Thiele. I guess he's not a young player like he was, but he came in and played. Billy Strings, incredible young guitar player, and Sierra Hall, Molly Tuttle. So it's might even be turning into a double album of a lot of old pieces that I never got to record because I went into the Flecktones and all these other kinds of music, and I'd written all these pieces for Bluegrass Ensemble. So I'm recording that, and it'll probably come out in the fall, and I'm going to do some touring in that world, which, again, I haven't done in a long, long time, and I'm looking forward to.
All right. My guest has been Bela Fleck. Bela will be performing with the Flecktones at State Theater New Jersey in New Brunswick on Friday at 8 p.m. Bela, thank you so much for joining us on All of It.
My pleasure. Thank you.